Book 1. In the Kingdom of the Blind. Chapter 1. The mountain had existed for tens of thousands of years, a rearing landmass of rock that had been willed into existence by forces greater than any living inhabitant of Agoru could imagine. Though its people had no knowledge of geology, the titanic forces of orogenic movement, compressional energies, and isostatic uplift, they knew enough to know that the mountain was too vast, too monumental, to be a natural formation. Set in the heart of an undulating salt plain, the ancients of the Agoru claimed had once been at the bottom of an ocean, the mountain rose to a height of nearly 30 kilometers, taller even than Olympus Mons, the great fabricator's forge on Mars. It dominated the blazing amber sky, a graceful, soaring peak shaped like an incredible tomb, crafted for some ancient king of magnificent cyclopean scale. No regular lines formed the mountain, and no artifice of mankind had shaped its rugged flanks, but one look at the mountain was enough to convince even the most die-hard skeptic that it had been crafted by unnatural means. Nothing grew on its rocky sides, no plants, gorse, or even the thinnest of prairie grasses. The earth surrounding the mountain shimmered in the baking heat of the planet's sun, which hung low on the horizon like an overripe fruit. Despite the heat, the rocks of the mountain were cold to the touch, smooth and slick, as though freshly raised from the depths of a black ocean. Sunlight abhorred its sides, its shadowed valleys, sunken grabens, and sheared clefts dark and cold, as though it had been built atop some frozen geyser that seeped its icy chill into the rock by some strange geological osmosis. Surrounding the rumpled skirts of the mountain, scattered collections of raised stones, each taller than three men, were gathered in loose circles. Such monuments should have been towering achievements, incredible feats of engineering by a culture without access to mechanical lifting equipment, mass-reducing suspensor gear, or the titanic engines of the Mechanicum. But, in the face of the mountain's artificial origins, they were primitive afterthoughts, specks against the stark, brooding immensity of its impossibility. On a world such as this, what force could raise a mountain? None of the many people gathered on Agoru could answer that question, though some of the greatest, most inquisitive and brilliant minds bent their every faculty to answer it. To the Agoru, the mountain was the axis mundi of their world, a place of pilgrimage. To the warrior scholars of the Thousand Suns, the mountain and its people were a curiosity, a puzzle to be solved, and, potentially, the solution to a riddle their glorious leader had sought to unlock for nearly two centuries. On one thing, both cultures agreed wholeheartedly. The mountain was a place of the dead.
"Can you see him?" asked the voice, distant and dreamlike.
"No."
"He should be back by now," pressed the voice, stronger now. "Why isn't he back?"
Ahriman descended through the enumerations, feeling the psychic presence of the three Astartes gathered beneath the scarlet canopy of his pavilion, with senses beyond the rudimentary ones nature had seen fit to gift him. Their potent psyches hummed through their flesh like chained thunder, that of Phocis Takar, tense and choleric, Hathor Martz lugubrious and rigidly controlled. Sobek's etheric field was a tiny candle next to the blazing suns they carried within them. Ahriman felt his subtle body mesh with his physical form and opened his eyes. He broke the link with his tutelary and looked up at Phocis Takar. The sun was low, yet still powerfully bright, and he squinted against it, shielding his eyes from the reflected glare of sunlight from the salt flats.
"Well?" demanded Phocis Takar.
"I don't know," he said.
"Apio can see no farther than the dead stones."
"Nor can Utapa," said Phocis Takar,
squatting on his haunches and flicking up puffs of salt dust with irritated thoughts. Ahriman felt each one like an electric spark in his mind. "Why can't the tutelary see beyond them?"
"Who knows?" asked Ahriman,
more troubled than he cared to admit. "I thought you'd be able to see further. You're Corvidae, after all."
"That wouldn't help here," said Ahriman,
rising smoothly from a cross-leg position and dusting glittering salt crystals from the inscribed crimson plates of his armour. His body felt stiff, and it took a moment for muscle memory to reassert control of his limbs after a flight in the ether.
"In any case," he said, "I don't think it would be wise to try on this world. The walls between us and the great ocean are thin, and there's a lot of unchanneled energy here."
"You're probably right," agreed Phocis Takar, sweat dripping down his shaven scalp along the line of an elliptical scar that ran from his crown to the nape of his neck.
"You think that's why we linger on this planet?"
"Entirely likely," said Ahriman.
"There is power here, but the Agoru have lived in balance for centuries without suffering any ill effects or mutations. That has to be worth investigating."
"Indeed it is," said Hathor Mart, apparently unaffected by the furnace heat.
"There's precious little else of interest on this parched rock, and I don't trust the Agoru. I think they're hiding something. How does anyone live in a place like this for so long without any signs of mutation?"
Ahriman noted the venom with which his fellow captain spat the last word. Unlike Ahriman or Phocis Takar, Hathor Mart's skin was pale, like the smoothest marble. His golden hair, like that, painted on the heroic mosaics of the Athenaeum. Not a bead of sweat befouled Mart's sculpted features.
"I don't care how they've done it," said Phocis Takar. "This place bores me. It's been 6 months, and we should be making war in the Arc Reach cluster. Lorgar's 47th are expecting us. Russ, too. And trust me, you don't want to keep the wolves waiting any longer than you must."
"The Primarch says we stay, so we stay," said Ahriman.
Sobek, his dutiful practicus, stepped forward and offered him a goblet of water. Ahriman drained the cool liquid in a single swallow. He shook his head when Sobek held a bronze hess out to refill it.
"No, take it to Remembrancer Eris," he commanded. "She is at the Deadstones and has more need of it than I."
Sobek nodded and left the shade of the canopy without another word. Ahriman's battle plate cooled him, recycling the moisture of his body and turning aside the worst of the searing heat. The Remembrancers that had come to the planet's surface were not so fortunately equipped, and dozens had already been returned to the Foteps Medicae decks, suffering from heatstroke and dehydration.
"You indulge the woman, Azek," said Hathor Mart. "It's not that hot."
"Easy for you to say," replied Phocis Takar, wiping sweat from his skull with a cleaning rag. "We can't all be Pavoni. Some of us have to deal with this heat on our own."
"With further study, meditation, and mental discipline, you might one day achieve a mastery equal to mine," replied Mart. And though his tone was jovial, Ahriman knew he wasn't joking. "You, Raptora, are belligerent sorts, but eventually you might be able to master the necessary enumerations."
Phocis Takar scowled, and a dense cluster of salt crystals flew from the ground beside him, aimed at Hathor Mart's head. Before it reached its target, the warrior's hand flashed, quick as lightning, and caught it. Mart crushed the mass of crystals, letting it spill from his hand like dust.
"Surely you can muster something better than that."
"Enough," said Ahriman. "Hold your powers in check, both of you. They are not for vulgar displays, especially when there are mortals nearby."
"Then why keep them around?" asked Mart. "Simply send her on her way with the others."
"That's what I keep telling him," said Phocis Takar. "If she's so damn keen to learn of the Crusade, send her to a legion that cares about being immortalized, the Ultramarines or Word-Bearers. She doesn't belong with us."
It was a familiar sentiment, and Ahriman had heard it 100 times from all his fellow captains. Takar was not the most vocal. That honour belonged to Kalophis of the 6th Fellowship. Whichever viewpoint Takar took, Kalophis would emulate more vociferously.
"Should we not be remembered?" countered Ahriman. "The writings of Callista Eris are among the most insightful I have read from the Remembrancer Order. Why should we be left out of the annals of the Great Crusade?"
"You know why," said Phocis Takar angrily. "Half the Imperium wished us dead not so long ago. They fear us."
"They fear what they do not understand," said Ahriman.
"The Primarch tells us their fear comes from ignorance. Knowledge will be our illumination to banish that fear."
Phocis Takar grunted and carved spirals in the salt with his thoughts.
"The more they know, the more they'll fear us. You mark my words," he said.
Ahriman ignored Phocis Takar and stepped out from the shelter of the canopy. The sensations of travelling in his subtle body were all but gone, and the mundane nature of the material world returned to him. The searing heat that had turned his skin the colour of mahogany within an hour of the storm bird touching down, the oily sweat coating his iron-hard flesh, and the crisp scent of the air, a mixture of burnt salt and rich spices, and the swirling etheric winds that swept the surface of this world. Ahriman felt power coursing through his body, glittering comet trails of psychic potential, aching to be moulded into something tangible. Over a century of training kept that power fluid, washing through his flesh like a gentle tide, preventing dangerous levels of etheric energy from building. It would be too easy to give in and allow it free rein, but Ahriman knew only too well the danger that represented. He reached up and touched the silver oak leaf worked into his right shoulder guard, and calmed his etheric field with a deep breath and a whispered recitation of the enumerations. Ahriman looked up at the towering mountain, wondering at the vast power of its makers and what the Primarch was doing inside it. Until the power to far see was taken away, he had not realized how blind he was.
"Where is he?" hissed Phocis Takar, echoing his thoughts.
It had been 4 hours since Magnus the Red had followed Yattiri and his tribe into the mountain, and the tension had been gnawing at their nerves ever since.
"You're worried about him, aren't you?" asked Hathor Mart.
"Since when could you master the powers of the Athenaean?" asked Ahriman.
"I don't need to. I can see you're both worried," countered Mart.
"It's obvious." "Aren't you?" asked Phocis Takar.
"Magnus can look out for himself," said Hathor Mart. "He told us to wait for him."
The Primarch of the Thousand Suns had indeed told them to await his return, but Ahriman had a sick feeling that something was terribly wrong.
"Did you see something?" asked Phocis Takar, noting Ahriman's expression. "When you travelled the Great Ocean, you saw something, didn't you? Tell me."
"I saw nothing," said Ahriman bitterly.
He turned and marched back into his pavilion, retrieving his weapons from a long footlocker of acacia and jade. He holstered a pistol that was as fine an example of the armourer's art as any crafted by the artificers of Vulcan salamanders, its flanks plated with golden backswept hawkwings, and its grip textured with stippled hide. As well as his pistol, he also bore a long hecker staff of ivory with a hooked blade at its end, its length gold-plated and reinforced with blue copper bands.
"What are you doing?" asked Hathor Mart when he emerged, accoutred for war.
"I'm taking the Sekhmet into that mountain," said Ahriman. "Are you coming?"
Lemuel Gauman reclined against one of the dead stones in the foothills of the enormous mountain, trying to keep within its shadow and wishing his frame was rather less fulsome. Growing up in the mid-continental drift hives of the Nordafrik enclaves, he was used to heat, but this world was something else entirely. He wore a long banyan of lightweight linen, colourfully embroidered with interlocking motifs of lightning bolts, bulls, spirals, and numerous other less easily identifiable symbols. It had been woven by a blind tailor in the Sangha Commercia subsid to his design, the imagery taken from the scrolls collected in the secret library of his villa in Mobei. Dark-skinned and shaven-headed, his deep-set eyes carefully watched the encampment of the Thousand Suns, while he occasionally made notes in a pad balanced on his thigh. Perhaps 100 scarlet pavilions dotted the salt plains, their sides tied up, each home to a band of Thousand Suns warriors. He'd noted which fellowships were represented: Ahriman's Scarab Occult, Anku Anen's Fourth, Kalophis's Sixth, Hathor Mart's Third, and Phocis Takar's Second. A sizable war host of Astartes warriors was encamped before the mountain. The atmosphere strangely tense, though Lemuel could see no cause for it. It was clear they weren't expecting trouble, but it was equally clear something was troubling them. Lemuel closed his eyes and let his consciousness drift on the invisible currents of the power that rippled in the air like a heat haze. Though his eyes were shut, he could feel the energy of this world like a vivid canvas of colour, brighter than the greatest works of Serena D'Angelis or Caelan Roget. Beyond the dead stones, the mountain was a black wall of nothingness, a cliff of utter darkness, as solid and as impenetrable as adamantium. But further out into the salt flats, the world was alive with colour. The Thousand Suns encampment was a blazing inferno of shifting colours and light, like an atomic explosion frozen at the instant of detonation. Even amid that blazing illumination, some lights shone brighter than others, and three such minds were gathered beneath where Lemuel knew Captain Araman's pavilion was pitched. Something preyed upon these minds, and he dearly wished he was strong enough to venture closer. A bright mind, a supernova amongst guttering candles, normally burned at the heart of the encampment, but not today. Perhaps that was the source of the Thousand Suns' tension. Their great leader was in absentia. Frustrated, Lemuel's mind drifted away from the Thousand Suns, and he let it approach the sunken dwellings of the Agoru. Cut into the dry earth, they were as dark and lifeless as the Thousand Suns were bright and vital. The Agoru people were as barren as the salt plain, without the slightest spark of a presence within them. He opened his eyes, exhaling and reciting the mantra of the Sangoma to calm his racing heartbeat. Lemuel took a drink from his canvas-wrapped canteen, the water warm and gritty but deliciously welcome. Three more canteens lay in the pack next to him, but they would only last the rest of the afternoon. By nightfall, he would need to refill them, for the remorseless heat let up only marginally during the hours of darkness.
"How can anyone live in this heat?" he wondered aloud for the hundredth time.
"They don't," said a woman's voice behind him, and he smiled at the sound. "They mostly live in the fertile river deltas further north or on the western coast."
"So you said, my dear Camille," he said. "But to willingly trek from there to this desolate place seems to defy all logic."
The speaker moved into view, and he squinted through the sun's glare at the young woman dressed in a tight-fitting vest, lightweight cut-off fatigues and dusty sandals. She carried a combination vox recorder and picta in a sling around her neck, and a canvas shoulder bag stuffed with notebooks and sketch pads. Camille Shivani cut an impressive figure with her sun-browned skin, long dark hair bound up beneath a loose turban of wrapped silk and dark glare shields. Her skin was ruddy brown, her manner forthright, and Lemuel liked her immensely. She smiled down at him, and he gave her his best, most winning smile in return. It was a wasted effort. Camille's appetites did not include the likes of him, but it never hurt to be courteous. "Lemuel, when it comes to humanity, even lost strands of it, you should know that logic has precious little to do with how people behave," said Camille Shivani, brushing her hands together to clear dust from the thin gloves she always wore.
"So very true. Why else would we linger here when there's nothing worth remembering?"
"Nothing worth remembering? Nonsense. There's lots to learn here," she said.
"For an archaeohistorian, maybe," he said.
"I spent a week living with the Agoru, exploring the ruins their villages are built upon. It's fascinating. You should come with me next time I make a trip."
"Me? What would I learn there?" he asked. "I study how societies form after compliance, not the ruins of dead ones."
"Yes, but what was there before has an impact on what'll follow. You know as well as I do that you can't just stamp one civilization on top of another without taking into account the previous culture's history."
"True, but the Agoru don't seem to have much history to supplant," he said sadly. "I don't think what they have will long survive the coming of the Imperium."
"You might be right, but that just makes studying them while we can even more important." Lemuel clambered to his feet, the effort causing him to break out in torrents of sweat.
"Not a good climate for a fat man," he said.
"You're not fat," said Camille. "You're generously portioned."
"And you are very kind, but I know what I am," said Lemuel, brushing his banyan free of salt crystals. He looked around the circle of towering stones. "Where are your companions?"
"Anku and Nen returned to the Fotep an hour ago to consult his Rosetta Scrolls."
"And Mistress Eris?" he asked.
Camille grinned. Callie's returning from taking rubbings from the dead stones on the eastern slope of the mountain. She should be back soon. Callista Eris, Camille and Anku Anen had spent hundreds of fruitless hours attempting to translate the graceful, flowing runes that wove around the dead stones. So far, they had met with limited success, but if anyone could decipher their meaning, it would be this triumvirate.
"Are you any closer to translating the script on the stones?"
asked Lemuel, waving a hand at the ancient menhirs. "We're getting there," said Camille, dropping her bag beside his and lifting the picture from around her neck. "Callie thinks it's a form of proto-Eldar, rendered in a dialect that's ancient even to them, which will make it next to impossible to pin down an exact meaning. But Anku Anen knows of some works on Prospero that might shed some light on the runes."
"On Prospero?" asked Lemuel, suddenly interested.
"Yes, in the Athenaeum, some big library the Thousand Suns have on their home world."
"Did he say anything about the library?" asked Lemuel.
Camille shrugged, taking off her glare shields and rubbing her gritty eyes. "No, I don't think so. Why?"
"No reason," he said,
smiling as he saw Callista Eris approaching the circle of dead stones and grateful for the distraction. Wrapped in a flowing white jalabia, Callista was a beautiful, olive-skinned young woman who, did she but desire it, had the pick of the male remembrancers attached to the 28th Expedition Fleet. And not that there were many remembrancers attached. The Thousand Suns were ruthlessly selective in choosing those allowed to accompany their campaigns and record their exploits. In any case, Callista declined every offer of companionship, spending most of her time with Lemuel and Camille. He had no interest in a liaison with either woman, content simply to spend time with two fellow students of the unknown.
"Welcome back, my dear," he said, moving past Camille to take Callista's hand.
Her skin was hot, the fingers charcoal-stained. She carried a drawstring bag over one shoulder, rolled-up sheets of rubbing paper protruding from its neck. Callista Eris was a student of history, one whose field of expertise was the manner in which knowledge of the past was obtained and transmitted. Once, in the library aboard the Fotep, she had shown Lemuel holopics of a crumbling text known as the Shiji, a record of the ancient emperors of a vanished culture of Terra. Callista explained how its factual accuracy had to be questioned, given that its author's intent appeared to be the vilification of the emperor previous to the one he now served. The veracity of any historical text, she explained, could only be interpreted by understanding the writer's intent, style, and bias. "Lemuel, Camille," said Callista, "do you have any water? I forgot to take extra."
Lemuel chuckled. "Only you would forget to take enough water on a world like this."
Callista nodded, running a hand through her auburn hair, her skin reddening even beneath her sunburn. Her green eyes sparkled with amused embarrassment, and Lemuel saw why so many desired her. She had a vulnerability that made men alternately want to protect or deflower her. Strangely, she seemed oblivious to this fact. Lemuel knelt beside his pack to retrieve a canteen, but Camille tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Save it. Looks like we're getting some brought to us." He turned and lifted a hand to shade his eyes, seeing one of the Astartes walking towards them with a bronze, oval-shaped vase held out before him. The warrior's head was bare, apart from a trailing topknot of black hair, and his golden-skinned features were curiously flat, his eyes dark and hooded like a cobra's. Despite the heat, Lemuel shivered, catching a flicker of cold power hazing the warrior's outline.
"Sobek," said Lemuel.
"You know him?"
"Of him? He's one of the Scarab occult, the Legion veterans. He's also Captain Araman's practicus," he said.
Seeing Callista's look of incomprehension, he added,
"I think it's a rank of proficiency of some sort, like a gifted apprentice or something."
"Ah." The Astartes warrior halted, towering over them like a solid slab of ceramite. His battle armour was gloriously intricate, the crimson plates engraved with geometric forms and sigils that Lemuel recognised as similar to those woven into his banyan. Sobek's right shoulder guard was stamped with a golden scarab,
while the left bore the serpentine star icon of the Thousand Suns. In the centre of the star was a black raven's head, smaller than the scarab, yet subtly given more relevance thanks to its positioning within the Legion symbol. This was the symbol of the Corvidae, one of the cults of the Thousand Suns, though he had been able to glean precious little of its tenets during his time with the 28th Expedition.
"Lord Araman sends this Hess of water," said Sobek.
His voice was sonorous and fulsome, as though produced in a deep well within his chest. Lemuel supposed the peculiar Astartes tone was due to the sheer volume of biological hardware within his body.
"That's very gracious of him," said Camille, holding her hands out to receive the Hess.
"Lord Araman instructed me to give the water to Remembrancer Eris," said Sobek.
Camille frowned and said, "Oh, right. Well, here she is."
Callista took the proffered Hess with a grateful smile.
"Please send Lord Araman my thanks," she said,
placing the heavy vase on the ground.
"It's most considerate of him to think of me."
"I shall pass your message to him when he returns," said Sobek.
"Returns?" asked Lemuel. "Where's he gone?"
Sobek glared down at him and then marched back towards his encampment. The Astartes had not answered his question, but Lemuel caught an upward flicker of Sobek's eyes towards the mountain.
"Friendly sort, isn't he?" remarked Camille. "Makes you wonder why we bother, eh?"
"I know what you mean. None of them are exactly welcoming, are they?" said Lemuel.
"Some are,"
pointed out Callista, emptying water into her canteen and managing to spill more than she transferred.
"Anku Anen has helped us, hasn't he?
And Captain Araman is quite forthcoming in his remembrances. I've learned a lot from him about the Great Crusade."
"Here, let me help you," said Lemuel, kneeling beside her and holding the vase steady.
Like most things designed for or by Astartes, it was oversized and heavy in mortal hands, more so now that it was filled with water.
"I'd be fascinated to read what you've accumulated so far," he said.
"Of course, Lemuel," said Callista. She smiled at him, and he felt his soul shine.
"So, where do you think Araman's gone?" asked Camille.
"I think I know," said Lemuel, with a conspiratorial grin. "Want to go look?"
The Sekhmet, the Scarab occult, Magnus's veterans, whichever name they bore, it was one of fierce pride and devotion. None of lower grade than a philosophus, the last cult rank a warrior could hold before facing the Dominus Liminus, these veterans were the best and brightest of the Legion. Having transcended their likes and dislikes, defied their mortality and broken down their idea of self, these warriors fought from a place of perfect calm. The Khan had called them automatons. Rushdie cried their fighting spirit, and Ferus Manus had likened them to robots. Having heard his Primarch's tales of the Master of the Iron Hands, Araman suspected the latter comment was intended as a compliment. Clad in hulking suits of burnished crimson Terminator armour, the Sekhmet crunched out over the salt plains and onto the lower slopes of the mountain. Araman felt the presence of his tutelary above him, sensing its unease as the psychic void beyond the dead stones loomed ever closer. Phocis Takar and Hathor Mart marched alongside him, their strides sure and eager. The shimmering forms of tutelaries darted through the air like wary shoals of fish in the presence of pack predators. Like Eightpio, the tutelaries of his fellow warriors and captains were fearful in the face of the mountain's emptiness. To those without ether sight, tutelaries were invisible, but to the Thousand Suns with power, they were bright visions of exquisite beauty. Eightpio had served Araman faithfully for nearly a century, its form inconstant and beautiful, a vision of eyes and ever-turning wheels of light. Utipa was a bullish entity of formless energy, as bellicose as Phocis Takar, where Paok resembled an eagle fashioned from a million golden suns, as vain and proud as Hathor Mart. Araman had thought them angels at first, but that was an old word, a word cast aside by those who studied the mysteries of the ether as too emotive, too loaded with connotations of the divine. Tutelaries were simply fragments of the primordial creator, given form and function by those with the power to bend them to their will. He linked his thoughts briefly with Apio's. If Magnus was in trouble, then they would need to find out without the sight or aid of their tutelaries. Though he had seen nothing tangible in any of his divinations, Adaman's intuition told him something was amiss. As Magister Templi of all Prospero's cults, Magnus taught that intuition was just as important a tool for sifting meaning from the currents of the great ocean as direct vision. Adaman suspected trouble, but Phocis Dakar and Hathor Mart longed for it. The 28th expedition had come to Ogoru 3 months ago. Its official designation in the War Council records was 2816, though no one in the 15th Legion ever called it that. Following the successful compliance of 2815, the 63 ships of the 28th expedition translated from the Great Ocean to find a system of dead worlds, empty of life and desolate. Indications were that life had once existed here, but now did not. What had caused such a system-wide cataclysm was unknown. But as the fleet made its way towards the sun, it became clear that life on the fifth planet had somehow survived the disaster. How Magnus had known this insignificant shoal of the galaxy had included a planet inhabited by a severed offshoot of humanity, it was a mystery, for there were no residual electromagnetics or long-dead emissions to suggest anything lived here. The Rehati urged Magnus to order the fleet onwards, for the crusade was at its height, and the Thousand Suns had their share of plaudits yet to earn. Nearly 2 centuries had passed since the crusade was launched in glory and fanfare. 2 centuries of exploration and war that had seen world after world folded into the body of the resurgent Imperium of Man. Of those 2 centuries, the Thousand Suns had fought for less than 100 years. In the early years of the crusade, prior to the coming of Magnus, the Astartes of the Thousand Suns had proven especially susceptible to unstable genes, resulting in spontaneous tissue rejection, vastly increased psychic potential, and numerous other variations from the norm. Labels like mutants and freaks were hung upon the Thousand Suns, and, for a time, it seemed as though they would suffer an ignoble ending as a footnote in the history of the Great Crusade. Then the Emperor's fleet had discovered Magnus the Red in a forgotten backwater of the galaxy, on the remote world of Prospero, and everything changed. "As I am your son, they shall become mine," were Magnus's words to the Emperor, words that had changed the destiny of the Thousand Suns forever. United with the Legion that carried his genetic legacy, Magnus bent every shred of his towering intellect to undoing the damage their aberrant genes had done. And he had succeeded. Magnus saved his legion, but the crusade had progressed in the time it had taken him to do it, and his warriors were eager to share in the glory their brothers were earning with every passing day. The expedition fleets of the legions pushed ever outwards from the cradle of humanity to reunify the Emperor's realm. Like squabbling brothers, each of the Primarchs vied for a place at their father's side, but only one was ever good enough to fight alongside the saviour of humanity. Horus Lupercal, Primarch of the Lunar Wolves and beloved son of the Emperor. The Emperor stood at the head of the Lunar Wolves and Guilliman's Ultramarines, ready to unleash his terrible thunder against the green skin of Ulanor, a war that promised to be gruelling and punishing. Who better than the favoured son of the Emperor to stand at his side as they throttled the life from this barbarian foe? Ulanor would be a war to end all wars. But there was fighting closer to hand that demanded the attention of the Thousand Suns. Lorgar's word-bearers and the Space Wolves of Leman Russ fought in the Arkreach Cluster, a group of binary stars occupied by a number of belligerent planetary empires that rejected the Imperium's offer to become part of something greater. The Wolf King had sent repeated calls for the 15th Legion to join the fighting, but Magnus ignored them all. He had found something of greater interest on Ogoru. He had found the Mountain.